We're too close to the enemy firepower at the front. This is where I've had a great experience with observation posts with the infantry. And one of them was in a place called Grosbeek. And this was right in no man's land, so to speak. And the infantry were deployed just in front of the house that I had taken over as an observation post. In the daytime, I observed through a tile taken out of the roof from the attic. And at night, we observed from one of the bedrooms. And one night, there was this terrible silence. In other words, you couldn't hear a thing. I was on duty alone about 2 o'clock in the morning. And the wireless had stopped. And you could hear it all the time. And this, nobody, it couldn't go off by itself because you'd have to flick the switch. And I knew all the men were sleeping in the basement 2 floors below. And I thought, now if I walk down the stairs, the steps are going to creak, because I knew they would. And so I listened for the longest time, and all of a sudden the wireless set came on again. So I thought, oh, heck with it. But in the meantime, I tried to contact the infantry on the little phone we had. No answer. And I found out later they'd all withdrawn and we hadn't been told. So there was nothing in front of us. So while I was still sitting there, I heard somebody marching up on the paved road, cobblestone road. And I thought, that's funny, who'd be marching this time of night? And we had no troops in front of us. So I looked out the window, watched and watched, and suddenly I saw this white figure moving along, and it was a goat. So I breathed a sigh of relief there, because we had very little protection, just our own rifles and pistols. There were only 4 of us there. Anyway, nothing further happened there, and I was relieved by somebody else and went back to the guns in Nijmegen. We held our Christmas dinner. They took one battery, or one troop, out at a time per day, starting on about the 22nd of December, right through, and gave them a little bit of Christmas cheer and a proper Christmas dinner, and we were billeted in houses there. And the local civilians were still there, and they slept in the basement, and we slept in the bedrooms, which is rather nice for a change.
How were the people in Holland? They didn't have much food during this period?
No, they had very little food. We helped to feed those we could. And
so they would probably be lucky to have soldiers billeted in their house?
Yes. They were very happy to have us, and they would give us tobacco, because they grew tobacco in their own yards as a rule. They gave mates their own cigarettes and cigars, although I didn't smoke much. And we would give them food regardless. And we even, when we had extras, we would cook things. Our cooks would make cakes and bread and things like that, and give some to the civilians. And when we moved out of, on the 8th of February, we moved into Germany, fought into Germany, and I went in with my crew to survey for the guns, and I went in a weasel. A weasel is a very small amphibious vehicle that holds 3 people, a driver and a co-driver and a wireless operator. And at that particular time, the Germans blew up the dike walls along the Rhine River, and the water started coming up, so we had to jump into the weasel and leave in a hurry. It was coming up very rapidly. And the weasel sank, so we had to swim ashore. Fortunately, it was uphill, and we had to choose another gun position in a place called Weiler, W-Y-L-E-R. And I had had an OP before that, looking into Weiler, and we saw this cow there all the time, facing us. And when we captured the place, the cow was still there, so we decided we better have some meat. So the MO came over and inspected it after it had been slaughtered, and said the meat that it was not tubercular, and that, well, we'd have to hang it for a few days. Some of the men couldn't wait with the obvious results, but they kept their braces down for a few days because they had dysentery practically. this area was heavily mined when we moved into it, and we had to be very cautious. Unfortunately, we were given a field that was not mined. But there's very very little land that wasn't surrounded by water, and when we moved into Cleve, we were again surrounded by water and no food. So we sent the men out searching, and we found a warehouse filled with sugar, so at least we had sugar. And we found about 3 months' supply of food in every house, tins of food and jars of jams and jellies and beans and things like that. So we managed fairly well. The plane came over and dropped our mail, but no food. And there we ended up going out of action for a little while to have another rest before crossing the Rhine River.
How well were you fed? Canadian government arm?
Very well indeed, really. Much better than we were in Korea later on. And I enjoyed the food there. And the only thing was that we did have an awful lot of bully beef set up with it. But they supplemented the rations as much as they could with better food. There was quite a bit of hardtack, and I lost a tooth because of that. I blame it on that anyway. And really, it had a lot of good food value. It was very hard to eat. I think it was left over from the First World War. We moved from there, and we made our crossing into Germany, not into Germany, we were already there, we made assault landings across the river, not the guns though. The guns crossed over at Emmerich, and across this very long Bailey Bridge, longest one ever built, I think. That stage was on pontoons, pontoon bridge. And moved from there into further into Germany, and then north into the eastern part of Holland, and went due north up into Friesland and Groningen.
Even the Hoxfall course around this time?
Yes, we. Before we went up into Holland, we were near the Hochwald Forest, and the map showed that we were deployed on a reverse slope. The map was wrong, we were on a forward slope, and the Germans were on a hill ahead of us, a place called Luisendorf, and they fired directly at our guns with 88s, and they wrecked all of our dial sights, which we used to lay the guns in the proper angle. And but we had one spare, and we had to use that for each gun separately to lay them, which is not very easy and not fast. And years later, I met one of these 88 millimeter gun officers here in Victoria. He'd migrated to Canada. I mean, he'd been firing at us. Of course, we were firing at him, too.
Who was that?
I can't remember his name now. I only fleetingly met him. One day, he was applying for a job at Goodwill Enterprises, and I happened to be there on training for my job with the BC government, and interviewed him. Odd. Nice chap. And the Hochwald Forest was right there, and we were so close to the target we were supposed to fire on that the rounds were bursting in the trees above our own infantry, so we had to stop firing. And wait till they were able to move quite a distance further inland, further into the forest and beyond. It was a very bad spot. This is where we first received our reinforcements from Canada, who were classified as zombies. Terrible name, but they were so well trained, because that's all they did in Canada was train, 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 that they turned out to be excellent soldiers. Very, very good. They knew how to drive, they knew how to gun drill very well, and so on. Quite young chaps, and really gave their all.
How were they treated?
They were accepted very well, but we were so short of men. By this time, we'd had so many casualties, and we didn't have any reinforcements until they arrived for quite a while. And so they were greeted with open arms, so our chaps could get some sleep. That doesn't sound as though we greeted them as people, individual people, but we dearly did in the long run. We wondered about them because we heard so many stories. But they all fitted in very well eventually. Although some were wounded, unfortunately, just coming up the road that day with mortars. So they could be seen.
And where were you until the end of the war?
Then we went up into Holland, and as I say, Friesland, and then we went into Germany, and we were fighting just south of Emden when the war ended, and we put on a victory parade on the 8th of May in Aurich, Emden, and other places around, and we kept changing the position of vehicles, and we put another battery or regiment in front of ours, and so on and so forth, to fool the Germans into thinking there were a great many more troops there than there were, because we were very thin on the ground. We didn't fool them, I don't think, but anyway, nothing happened. There's one gun position I'd like to mention. We went into this position, and without the guns, we were doing our survey before they came in. Went into this farmhouse, there were no civilians around, and the stove was still burning in the kitchen, coal stove, and there was a cake in the oven. And I decided to shave because there was hot water. So I was shaving, and all of a sudden I saw in the mirror two Germans standing in the doorway with rifles. And my men were in the same room, two of them, but they were over in another corner, didn't see them. So I said, ahem, and they looked and they saw these Germans, and I said, hold it. And I didn't have my pistol with me, it was lying on a table. And so I said, Hand a hoch. So they put their rifles down and put their hands up in the air. And we took them prisoner. And that's what they wanted. They were giving themselves up. They were in their 20s, I would say. So we took them back to where regimental headquarters was supposed to be, and they weren't there. And we saw all these vehicles, German-looking vehicles, and the type of vehicles that gypsies use to sleep in and so on. And
caravan.
Yeah, caravan type. And we didn't see a soul around, and then suddenly somebody came out with their hands up, and it was a German soldier. And it turned out that it was a TOT organization, the engineers who had built the Atlantic Wall and bridges and all kinds of things in the German forces. And there was a general in charge of them, and he gave himself up to us and all his men. Now we had these two German soldiers and all these people, and there were three of us when, fortunately, our regimental headquarters appeared on the scene, and they got some MPs up and took them back. But the general wanted to keep his pistol, or we wouldn't allow it. And he wanted to be treated by a person with the same rank. And of course, we didn't have any generals nearby. And so I said, well, I'm sorry, but you'll have to pretend that I'm a general. But he was going supposedly by the Geneva Convention. Anyway, that's when the war ended. We were in Germany, and about the middle of May, we moved back into Holland to Ada, just there overnight, and then took up billets in Bilthoven and with civilians. Then eventually moved into the former Dutch army barracks in Utrecht, which the Germans had used, of course, when they were there, Wilhelmina Barracks. And the men lived there, and we had our regimental headquarters there, and we used houses in Wilhelmina Park that the Germans had used for their officers. And they were furnished, of course, and waited our turn to come back to Canada.
How long did that take?
Till December. This is in May. We were in Holland until December.
What activities would the men engage in during this period? It was after the war. Was there discipline still strict?
Yes, discipline was still strict. We held parades to account for the men and make sure that everyone was there, and to tell them what was new and what could be done. And we arranged for dances for them and other parties for sports. They played baseball against the Dutch in Ajax Stadium in Amsterdam. And They played hockey in the winter. They even played against the Belgians in Antwerp. I took my whole troop down to see Vimy Ridge, back again. Of course, we saw all the different sites in Belgium, other parts of France on the way. And we opened up a regimental yacht club in the lakes near Hilversum, and we took over a place called at the Plas House. And the Germans had taken the yachts away from the Dutch, and the Dutch had records of them, of course. So we found out who owned them, and we kept them. We had about 18 yachts, and told the Dutch that they could have them back as soon as we finished with them, provided they would teach us how to sail, and also they could become members of our mess and they could have all the food they wanted there, or the club, yacht club. Worked out beautifully. It was for all ranks, and we learned to sail, and we sailed on the lakes there, and it was, then you could swim, of course, so like a real summer resort when the weather was warm. Later on in the winter, of course, we could still sail in the colder weather, not swim. We had, the officers had quite a few mess dinners in Hilversum, in the some of these places that were very nice hotels with dining facilities and bars, of course, and where we used to run into a lot of friends from way back. And I ran into my cousin who had been fighting in Italy for the first time in ages. We went back to England via, to Canada via Aldershot, England, and were there for a couple of weeks and then sailed from Liverpool to Halifax. And I got off in Halifax and went home.
Down the street?
Yes, so to speak.
Did you always plan on staying in the Army?
No. I'd been offered a promotion, as a matter of fact, when we were in action, and I turned it down because I figured, no, I want to stay with where I am. I know everybody. So on. I wasn't planning on making a career. I thought I'd go into journalism. So I went to Acadia University to study first. Then I changed my mind and thought I would teach. And so I took history. I ended up with a master's degree at Acadia University in military history. I wrote my thesis on the Canadian militia from 1604 to 1950. And a copy of which is still in the Acadia Library, I'm told. Of course, I have one. And but during my last year in university, the Korean War was on. I was in the class of 1950. The Korean War started in 1950. And they started recruiting a brigade to send to Germany and one to Korea. So I decided to go back in the armed forces. At the time, I was president of the Veterans Association of Acadia University. And I mentioned it at one of the meetings, and a great many of us decided we'd go. So they sent a bus up from Halifax, and we all went down, were tested again, and we went. So we were taken on and given leave of absence with pay at the lowest pay of an officer until we graduated, and then we were given back rank. And during my master's degree year, I was back in the Armed Forces on leave of absence. And then I was posted to an airborne battery in Shiloh, Manitoba. I had tried during the war to become a paratrooper, so my mother found out, and through my father, she had it canceled. I don't blame her, looking back. Really was suicide, not many of them came back. And anyway, I was posted to an airborne artillery battery in Shiloh, Manitoba, the 1st Light Battery Para, RCA, and immediately went on a course in Rivers, Manitoba, and finished the course in Shiloh with Jump Tower. It was great fun until the third jump, and then you begin to realize what you're doing. But the fourth and fifth jumps weren't too bad. The fifth one was at night when you can't see the ground or judge your distance.
From a tower?
Yeah, no,
from
a plane in Rivers. And you have to learn to roll and you were prepared to roll all the time. Unfortunately, there was no wind that night. You could practically stand up, not allowed to. Get used to standing up. You do it when you shouldn't because of the wind, and you break a leg or two. So you learn to bend your leg and roll as you on your side. You end up with your legs hitting the ground the other side. Stops your rolling. So that then they posted me from there to 216 Battery in London, Ontario. Lovely city. And from there we were I went to lieutenant to captain course in Shiloh, Manitoba, and went directly from there to Wolfville, Nova Scotia to get married to a Dutch girl. and I was, in the meantime, the battery was posted to Shiloh, Wainwright, Alberta, where the regiment was formed, the 81st Field Regiment was formed there. And there we were told we were going to Korea as a regiment. And previously we'd been told we were going to Germany.
So happy about this change? Or?
In a way, yes. In another way, no, because my wife's Dutch and we were hoping we'd go to Germany and be able to go to Holland and visit her mother and her parents, her relatives from time to time, and eventually end up in Korea if it was still on. But the reverse happened, although we never did get to Germany because I ended up with polio after Korea. So we did our training, some training of the regiment in Wainwright, and then we were posted to Petawawa, and more training there, and we were able to bring our wives, if we had them, to Pembroke, and we left from Petawawa to go overseas to Korea.
From the same station that...
Same station from, as I had from the second, to go to the Second World War. It seemed like history repeating itself. And we went by train, and we had a little regimental band, and every time the train stopped, the band would get off and parade up and down the platform and play, and we'd get off and stretch our legs. And this happened in Saskatoon, and again in, Brandon, I guess. Yeah, Brandon, Manitoba, and Saskatoon. And we ended up in Seattle and took one of those Liberty ships from Seattle to Yokohama. And they were welding it together all the way across the Pacific. It was so old, mm-hmm. by this time, having been built in the Second World War. And we went by train from there as a regiment to Hero, which was the Canadian Administration Center for the Canadians over there. And we just regrouped there and then went by ferry from Curie to the to Busan, south of South Korea, and ended up on a train with seats the same as the old streetcar, wooden slat seats, and we were on it for 22 hours to Weejongbu from Busan. But just before just as we were taking off in Busan, the engine went off the tracks. So we were sitting on this train waiting in the heat. It was terribly hot, even though it was in March. Early April. And very hot, and a steam engine too. We had to wait until a train came along, put it back in the track. And then we did go, and it took 22 hours, as I said. And no toilets on board, just a hole in the floor, and in what should have been a bathroom. And no water. We had hot coffee the next morning and some sandwiches. And we saved half of the coffee to shave with, so we'd appear decently for our reception in Weejongbu. So we met with trucks in Weejongbu and were driven up to the regiment. And I dropped my excess baggage and went straight on up to the observation post to relieve Jack DeHart, who was with our regiment and was over in advance with the Van Dues. So I took over from him with the Van Dues and had to practice my French. which wasn't very good, of course, because I hadn't practiced it for years, although I had 9 years of French in school and university. But one night I noticed, coming out of the observation post and looking at my bunker, which was underground, the bunker was on fire. So I went to, I grabbed the first man who came along, and I said in English, "Have you got a shovel? There's a fire down there." And he said, "Je ne comprends pas." So I said to him in French, "Have you got a shovel?" Le feu, which means fool. Feu is fire. I pronounced it incorrectly, I was so excited. And he laughed, and finally I got through to him that it was a fire, and he got a shovel. We put it out. The floor was earth, you see, so we just dug up the floor. But in that position, when the 3rd Battalion RCR came in, the Royal Canadian Regiment, I was an observation post officer with this C battery, or C company, of the 3rd Battalion. And they were welcomed to Korea by the Chinese who were facing us, a loud speaker in very good English. And they were just moving in when they were welcomed. Said goodbye to the Vandus and hello, 3rd Battalion, Royal Canadian Regiment, commanded by so-and-so, and who's a capitalist from Toronto, and all this business. Yeah, all of which was true. And on the second night of the 2nd, 3rd of May, they decided to attack us, and they overran our position. And there were 120 of us on the hill, about 85 casualties. And the attack was so intense, and there were about 1,200 of them, we found out later, and ran over our position, so I had to bring fire down on top of us to get rid of them, and it seemed to work. And then they, the next morning in daylight, couldn't find any of them. There was only one dead body found. They had a work battalion follow them up without weapons to pick up their dead and wounded and carry them back to their own side, at the same time taking our prisoners as well. And a lot of the information we got was from the prisoners who were released later on when the war supposedly was over. Ceasefire.
What was your impression of Korea and the Korean people?
Korean people were very, very nice people, very difficult to talk to because they didn't understand English. The people who did speak English were very high-ranking people in the government or military or priests of the Anglican or Roman Catholic faith or other Protestant faith. Very, very nice people. Couldn't do enough to make you feel at home. But we seldom saw them because they skirt line, as they called it, was 10 miles behind us, and we rarely got into Seoul. I think about 3 times during the fighting. And later, I went to Incheon in the jeep once with a friend and his driver, and met a few civilians there, very, very polite, very nice, very happy to be liberated, but there's so poor, the country places were really shacks made of mud, straw, and straw roofs. But very ingenious people. The children still had little games that were made by their parents. They played all kinds of things. They made little things so they could skate on the ice. I don't know what they're made of. They were made of. And never wasted a thing. Used cardboard on the walls to keep to insulate and so on.
Anything else you'd like to say about the Korean War? You were given the Military Cross during...
Oh yes, it was partly because, mainly because of the action that night. The Chinese attacked us, and one of my men was given the Military Medal because of it. I'm sorry, he was given the medicine dispatches because he had taken a great chance. Our wireless was knocked out, and he took a great chance in going out into the trenches to repair the line that led from the set itself into our observation post. And two other men were killed in the bunker they slept in, because a shell landed right in the doorway of the bunker. So I was very pleased in the summer when Major General Mike West, who was the British commander of the British Commonwealth Division, bestowed the Military Cross upon a few of us, and the mess and dispatches and I signaler. And then when we got back to Canada, General Massey, the Governor General of Canada, pinned the Military Cross on and other decorations on a few of us from the Maritimes in Halifax, which was very, very nice, you know, to have him do it as our Governor General. The Korean War, I still think, was worthwhile for the Koreans. It really is still in very bad condition as far as possibility of the North invading again. But I think they're getting closer and closer to talking to each other more sensibly than they ever were before, hopefully. Yeah. Coming back from the war, we were stationed in Utopia, New Brunswick, after I had had my 2 months leave in Europe, and I developed polio. I had the same symptoms in Korea that led up to the diagnosis of polio, but the medical people say that it's impossible to incubate for that length of time, so they don't blame it on Korea. So I was in the hospital for quite a while, but I stayed in the army and got back, although I was told by the doctor I'd never walk again, I can walk. And if it hadn't been for an excellent physiotherapist in Halifax and Camp Hill Hospital, I don't think I would have recovered as well as I did. So I was able to stay in and do desk jobs, and posted to headquarters in Halifax, and as personnel officer in Camp Gagetown, New Brunswick, and personnel officer in Halifax, and then from Gagetown, actually, to Acadia University as a resident staff officer for 4 years, which was rather nice to go back to my hometown and my alma mater. And it was a very pleasant posting. And it was very nice teaching young men, university students, who a great many of whom ended up in the Armed Forces later, COTC and ROTP. I had not only Acadia University, but I had Dalhousie and King's